Well, thank you. Thank you, Michael. Yes, I'd like to start off by thanking all the organizers for giving me an opportunity to speak. And when Don, you sent that email out about the title on the talk, my initial goal or plan was to talk about what kind of strategies I use in my own research group to get my undergraduate students engaged in research. But as I started actually making the talk, and especially listening to the introduction and the welcome on Monday, and participating in all the sessions, I kind of realized that a more appropriate title of the talk would be this. But those of you who don't realize it, this is cat pooey, right? but there's a small twist here, because it actually lives in an extra dimension. And well, the two S's over here stand for survival and strategy. So really my talk is about, if you are a young theorist in a department where there is no possibility or opportunity for you to be mentored, how do you survive? How do you come up with a strategy? Because when I joined my department, which was Augusta State University in 2007, I really didn't have a lot of mentoring. So what I want to do today is to actually share my experiences with you of establishing a research group at a primarily undergraduate institution. As I move along with the talk, you're going to find slides where there's a little star on the title. And the star basically stands for discussion point slides. Feel free to chime in as I'm speaking, or feel free to ask questions at the end. Either way, I'd like for the talk to be interactive. And anything that I share in this is just my opinion. It's not, I'm not trying to go against anyone's philosophy or anyone's idea. I'm sure all of you are experienced and successful here, so it's nothing against anyone here. So, okay. So with that, let me go back and talk about a little history here. Augusta State University was a primarily teaching institution. Georgia Regents University, as of 2012, after we got merged into this new institution and with this name, is no more a primarily teaching institution. It's building up towards to be an R1. So we are going towards a transitional period. But the department still is. We do not have any graduate students. We primarily cater to undergraduates. We have all the issues and the problems that any other PUI institution would have, and that we discussed during this little group sessions that we did. And when I was hired in 2007, the goal that was given to me by my chair was, can you help us establish an undergraduate research program? Now, the computational and the theoretical part came by default, because that's what I'm trained in. I am trained in pen and paper, condensed matter physics, okay? My training is in using field theory in one dimension, and I applied it to quantum wires. So I wasn't trained in computational. I actually hated computers. I did not know how to code much. All I knew was to do Mathematica. That was my maximum programming. You know, I can do Mathematica. You tell me C++, Fortran, I'm scared. I'm going to run away. So that's how I entered the picture in 2007. At first when I got to Augusta State, there were a lot of issues that I came across, practical obstacles. Here's my chair who's asking me to do something, and these are the stuff that I'm seeing. First problem, there is no culture of theoretical or computational physics research. Oh my God. Okay, because it comes with a scare factor. At least in the department that I was in, or in the locality that I was in, most students think of theory as being scary. Okay, it is a romantic notion to a lot of the students, because they either see Big Bang Theory or they read books when they are, high school, and they think, oh wow, I can do this stuff in physics, but they don't know how to do it, so they're scared. They don't want to come talk to you. The other thing is physics, theoretical physics is abstract, right? And in this world of instant gratification, and something has to happen in the next nanosecond, what does it mean? How do you convince a student who's walked into your door that theoretical physics is relevant to what you do? Okay, that's a big problem. There's a lack of time to train students. Every PUI researcher that I've talked to, they've always told me, oh, I get the student after 2 years when they've gone through their coursework, and by the time I'm done training them, I have lost the student. Well, all my time was wasted. I could not put them on a publication, or I could not take them to a conference, or I couldn't do this or couldn't do that. A lack of time is a practical issue, okay? Then there's a question of my training, which I had, and I talked about that. So the question is, then what are accessible, and I'd like to use a term that Alex used in the 2013 conference, what are the low-hanging fruit projects that we can give to students? Okay? These projects might not be our traditional research topics or projects that we, as someone who's active in the professional field or from an R1 institution, would say, this is a research topic. It is not for at that level, but for a student it might be. So we need to think about what we can do there. How do you motivate and encourage students? And this fact ties up with the scare factor and the abstractness of the discipline. And finally, this is more important from an institutional perspective and also from a grant perspective. If you're submitting a grant, you need to let them know, how would you measure the success of your program? Because there's no use saying in your proposal that, oh, I'm very good. No, they don't care. You need to show them data, okay? That's very important. So these are the obstacles that I was faced with. Although some of these are coming in from, so for something like this, I realized after having failed to get a grant and then after having gotten it. So that's from experience. But some of these are not from, they were just my initial issues that I faced. So usually what I do, and here's the solution, this is what I do, and this is a strategy I'm sure a lot of you use. Okay, this is not unique to me. There are some tweaks I'm sure that some of you do, but this is the general scheme of structure that I employ. I like to spot students early on, okay? And Irene, I think, talked about this on her talk on Monday. Get them early, okay? I'll tell you a little story here. When I was in graduate school back home in India, doing our master's program, Citibank, credit card company, right, came up and gave us free credit cards, okay, with a balance on the card that we could use. So I went back home that summer and told my father, oh, I got a free credit card. He said, yeah, because you're a fool. I said, why? Because what they did, they got you in the market now. Once you use it, you're hooked with them, right? And they hooked you on early when you were a graduate student, okay? At that time, credit cards were not, at least in India, where they were not in fashion, okay? They were trying to market it. So you got to get them early on. And then there is a period of initial training that they go through, and I'll elaborate more on these points, what I mean by initial training. And then they come to the main project, okay? A lot of the people tend to get the students when they think about giving them the main project. We don't tend to think about these two steps as being important, but they are, and I'll show you why they are. And then comes the presentation and the publication, which is the dissemination of the work, and eventually you enthuse and motivate, and this cycle keeps on running. Okay, so this is the general machinery that has to be implemented. Okay, go ahead.
One sort of other ramp into this problem, or just some other thing to consider, is sometimes, like in our department, every student must do a senior research mm-hmm. project. So it's not so much about, so sometimes it's not a question of talent spotting. It's about, what am I going to do with Joe?
Okay, so I have an answer for that. I have an answer for that. So let me get back to that point in maybe towards the end of the slide. While we do not have a formal requirement, there is a way that we have been able to circumvent it. So I'll share that with you, maybe in 10, 15 minutes or so. Okay, so let me elaborate a little bit more about what these mean. So the first phase of talent spotting, where do you get them from? Let's say if departmental research is not a requirement, which it is not in many institutions, how do you get them? Well, you get them from introductory courses, word of mouth, or physics club. These are three possible strategies. There are many other avenues of doing it, but these are just simply three possible strategies. Introductory courses. Well, I'm teaching physics 11-11, which is for trig-based, an algebra-based physics course. How would you get a physics major out of it? Or how would you be able to excite someone in that class to come do work with you on strongly correlated magnetism? Well, here is how you do it. On the day that you're teaching magnetism, not only do you show them a bar magnet, but you put up a few slides on the work that you do, okay? Let's say you don't work on magnetism. Let's say you work on elasticity. The day that you're teaching elasticity, you show them a few stuff on elasticity research that you do. So what I'm trying to say is that we tend to think that students will come to us because how great of a researcher we are, and God, I'm the best, you should come to me. No, that's not how it works. You need to go to them, okay? You need to come down to earth and tell them, look, these are the great, beautiful things which are out there. And a lot of them are ignorant, okay? When I was in high school, I did not know what was a triangular lattice antiferromagnet and that it could have spin-ons on them, and there was a spin ice and a spin liquid state. But they existed. I didn't know that. That doesn't mean that that thing is not important. So how would somebody know? In our field, in theoretical physics, the biggest problem I feel we have is a lack of proper PR. We tend to think that what we are doing is the best, so everybody will come to us. Unfortunately, the world has moved on. We need to go people and show how it's really beautiful and good. So we need to go and capture them first. And a way to do it is to talk about it in your classes. The word of mouth thing develops once you've developed your research group after a few years, and then people will come to you. Physics club, that's a more formalized machinery, and departments in which physics clubs are active are good, but there's some departments where the physics club goes in waves. Like if you have a couple of good undergraduates, they will do really well, and then it will go down, it will go up. So I'm not sure. I've never recruited out of the physics club though, but I've recruited mostly from my trig-based, algebra-based courses or calculus-based physics courses, okay? To make them into physics majors. I've even made biology majors into physics majors, okay? So it is possible. It is possible to do it. You just have to know what takes them in physics. So that's one thing. When I get a student, we have an honest conversation, what my expectations are. And I tell them, I'm not here to do a semester's worth of work with you. I've gotten you at your second year of freshman or your first year of sophomore, so you're going to be working with me for the next 3 to 4 years. But before we get there, we need to understand how both of us work. You may like me, I may like you, but we may not like working with each other in a professional sense that, you know, both of us are interested in the same project. So we have an honest conversation of what the expectations are. And usually the first project that I do is a skill building project. I do not engage them in any of the research stuff that I do. But I know in the work that I do, I use Mathematica, I use MATLAB, I do projects on magnetism, or I would do projects on chaos, which are accessible. So what I make them do is I make them take special topics courses with me, okay? Now looking at these books, you would say, well, what's special about these books? This has been around for so many centuries. There's nothing special. But let me ask all of you this question. How many of you go from chapter 1 to chapter 20 of this book in a semester? Do all of us finish every textbook that we touch? No. If you look at Dan Schroeder's book, there are chapters in the end which talk about phase transition, which talk about renormalization group, which talk about Ising model. Those are special topics for those students who take thermal physics classes. So what I do in a semester when I offer thermal physics, immediately the semester which comes after it, I do a one-credit special topics course. And the way I pitch it to them is I say, look, you bought this book, right? They go, yes. How much did you pay? Oh, $100. Yeah, did you use it? No. Okay, now we're going to use it. How do you do that? You come and take this one credit class. And guess what? Once they finish the book, they come to you and tell you know what? I really learned this because not only did I revise my thermal physics concepts, but I also learned how this can be useful in a research perspective. Okay, but now not all special topics courses can be like, you know, designed in this manner. For example, computational physics. When I engage my students, I engage them in computational work, and not a lot of them had programming beforehand. So what I tend to do is I tend to pick the first chapter of the book and teach them Euler method. And I leave it up to them what kind of language they want to use, if they've already had a prior knowledge of language, or if not, I impose my own will, which is MATLAB or Mathematica. So I keep that flexible, okay? But we talk about pseudocodes and we talk about how the algorithm works and we get them. But the point that I'm trying to get to is that these courses are absolutely vital and they run in parallel with the research meetings and research stuff that I do. So when I tell a student I've accepted you, most probably that semester there is a research topic, special core topics course that I'm offering that they're going to come and sit in the class and learn from them. What does it do? It cuts down on your time. It cuts down on the time for them to learn the topic, okay? And it helps them to come up to par or standard with what you can expect them to do in research. As far as topics go for initial project training, as I just mentioned, I typically tend to pick back of the chapter projects. Like if you take a book on mechanics, right? The mechanics books tend to have a lot of chapters on chaos and nonlinear science. I at least cannot get to all of that in one semester, so I use those as initial projects. And I've had students who have done work in that direction. I'll give you some examples of what I've done there. So once this initial training period is over, right, we go into the main project. Let me give you a sense of the timeline. I have a first-year sophomore or a second-year freshman who I get, that entire year, that sophomore year, they work with me on these basic projects. And then they come and work with me on magnetism, which is my area of research. I have students who've worked on chaotic oscillators, who've worked on just, you know, things like magnetic bacterias, who have worked on Ising model simulations, which have sometimes seemingly nothing to do with the main project that they're about to do. And I let them know that. You're not doing this project because this is what your final thesis will be. You're doing it because you need to train yourself. I need to know you know how to think, and I need to teach you how to think. So that's what the main purpose is. So typically my students start to get into the main project in their first junior year. That's when they get in. And another thing that I've started doing lately is engaging them in collaborations, external collaborations, but that's been a recent phenomenon. I never did that early on. And the type of projects that are available to them are typically computational or theoretical, okay? And once this is settled, we work on this for a while, and then I take them off to these meetings, and I emphasize the importance of publications and presentations at all possible levels. I've taken my students at APS March meeting for the beginning 2009, so they've been going there every year. To present at a national meeting, okay? I think that's very important. Presenting at the local meetings are important, and the Phi Kappa Phi, this is a local research conference that we do on campus, and I've been the chair of it, and I'm still part of the committee, but I encourage them to submit there. And all of this ultimately culminates into this materials research seminar series that I've recently started in about a year, where we invite external speakers nationally and internationally to come give a talk. And this last piece is, somebody was asking me, how do you let the administrators know it's useful? If they don't believe you, email an R1 institution professor. They have a lot of money to go out there and do outreach. But sometimes they cannot come down to the PUIs because they're just not invited. And you don't even have to pay for them. If you ask them to come give an invited talk, you've actually started this thing. And when you get pizza money, okay? Get the students in there. And once your dean comes and sees this, the dean says, oh, the students are so interested in theoretical physics. Okay, you know what? I'll give you $2,000 over summer to get two students in. So how you organize this sometimes depends on, in my particular strategy, this came in much later. Because I had to prove these first before they gave me money for that. In your case, this might come first, you know? Because remember, if you go back to the thing, this looks like what? It's a circle, right? You can start anywhere over here. I mean, it kind of looks like it's cyclic on it's all going in itself. The publication and the presentation part obviously is that cannot come in there. But these two, you can switch them around. Okay, so this is the strategy that I've used actually over the years on how to make them do things. Here is my research focus in short. I basically work on quantum and classical aspects of magnetism, okay? And yeah, if you tell me magnetism, I'm in, okay? You don't even have to convince me. That's what I work on. So on this slide, I want to talk some about the practical obstacles that we have as a faculty. Everything that I talked about till now was student issues. How do you get students in there? A PUI theorist life can be lonely. When I was in there, I was the only theorist. I convinced the department to hire another one. We still don't talk. He works in his office. I work in my office. So we're still lonely.
You're lonely together.
Yeah, we're lonely together. But, you know, this is where I have a question. A lack of departmental research focus, the pros and cons which come with it. I've always advocated for the fact that if you are a PUI department, I feel you should have a focus in a certain area so that you can grow up as a team. You know, you hire three people, one experimentalist in a correlated electron direction, a theorist in it, and a computational guy. Now three of you can build a team with which you can submit a proposal to NSF, and NSF will buy that, okay? Rather than you being the only sole person saying, oh, I'm the best, I can do it on my own. That's much a harder sell. So I don't, that's my idea there. But let's say you don't have access to that. Let's say you don't have enough money to have new hires, and you're the only theorist who's going to be there for the rest of your life. So don't panic, then just seek help, okay? And in my case, that help came in through these collaborations that I have. Now, these two collaborations developed in different ways. Daoshen, I knew him as a postdoc when he was a postdoc in my advisor's research group, okay? So he got a faculty position back in China, and we were talking one day, and he said, hey, why don't you come here and mentor my graduate students? I said, I'd love to do that. So ever since then, in summer, I go to China. So, and we publish papers with his graduate students. I'm their direct mentor, and I'll show you some stories there of what we have. So I work for him. That's how that started off. This one is a little different. As a scholar, when I used to come to KITP in 2013, when I was here, they had a spintronics conference. We were talking, I met him and I asked him, I'm interested in this kind of physics, and we started to work. But the great thing about these two collaborations are not the collaborations in my mind. They are this one. But you know why? Because even before I started doing all of that, if you're listening to my talk, I told you that I was trained in an area of 1D quantum wires, bosonization field theory. I don't work in that area anymore. I said magnetism. Two reasons why there's magnetism there. First reason, I've always wanted to do magnetism research, but my graduate school did not have any program in it. So I said, okay, I'll get a PhD in something else. And because I was able to come to a PUI, I did not have any research focus or agenda. I could fail doing magnetism, or I could succeed doing magnetism. So I chose to pursue my dream, which is work in that thing. And the very first few papers that I published in magnetism was with another PUI faculty, who, by the way, I was able to get to through the Anacapa Society member website, because I was clicking and browsing through it, and I see, oh, this guy, he works on magnetism, so let me shoot him an email and see if he's interested in working. So the very first few papers I published was with him, okay? And then it branched off into, we still talk, we don't necessarily actively collaborate, but we exchange ideas. So, but from there it branched off into this bigger and broader collaborations. So that's one of the reasons why I feel that as Anacapa Society members, we don't tend to use us or each other more. It's much more easier to convince one of you to collaborate with me than walking into an R1 institution and say, hey, work with me. Now, if you can work with your advisor, you can work with your graduate advisor, postdoc advisor, that's clearly possible, but what if you don't want to do that? What if you want to venture out in something different? What if you don't want to step on their toes so that when you submit a grant, they're not going to, the reviewers are going to come back and say, oh, your advisor's already doing this. Why would I care funding you? So you need your own area, okay? And to do that can be difficult with that strategy. Any questions if I'm going too fast? Okay, so the ultimate goal then is to create a form of synergy. And this is a discussion topic that came about when our group is, how do I do this? You know, students want this, they're not productive, they're underprepared. I have to publish in PRB or PRD or PRL, and boy, there's no way you can put them together. Well, what you need to do is you need to understand the synergy that every research topic in here it's broken down as classical or quantum, but in your particular area there's a breakdown where undergraduates can contribute and you can contribute in that area. And once the machinery starts to go, they all come in together. Let me give you an example. When I started working on magnetism, the very first projects I did was Ising model non-equilibrium simulations to study something called dynamic phase transition. That had nothing to do with spin wave theory in quantum Heisenberg magnets, except for the word magnetism. But as I started working in these two seemingly two separate limits, I started to teach myself magnetism, okay, to the collaborations. And slowly now I've reached a point where my research universe overlaps. On the upper hemisphere are projects where I engage undergraduates in. The common theme here is computational. On the lower half of the universe are theoretical pen and paper projects which I engage with my external collaborators. And there's a fuzzy boundary in between where computational work and theoretical work overlap. For example, this X-ray spectral work is a collaboration that I have with Utrecht University in Netherlands, okay? That's with a chemist. Actually, a chemist who's an experimentalist. And I'm a theorist, okay? We compute X-ray absorption spectras, and I have an undergraduate student who's engaged in it. This work was done with a professor from Australia, okay? This work over here was done solely by me because it was accessible enough for me to do. But this is the universe that I wanted to create for myself, where I had two seemingly different hemispheres, but there is always an overlap. It doesn't matter what research project you do. If you lay it out this way as a PUI faculty, your time will become much more efficient. You'll be able to see how to manage your time much better. The project on resonant inelastic X-ray scattering is what I did with Daoshen and from China, Neutron, all of this. This is the project that I'm pursuing in Japan, and this is a work that my undergraduate is doing. But then again, these two projects are pretty hard for an undergrad. The one that I have is pretty good. So those are some things you got to be able to figure out if they can do it or not. And whenever I choose my projects, there's a dial that I'm turning, which is classical to quantum, where typically if it's a classical physics project, I have my undergraduates be engaged in it. And if it's an external collaborator, it's usually a quantum project which involves quantum physics. But there's a fuzzy boundary in here, and that fuzzy boundary were these two projects, undergrad, where they overlapped. So there are places where you will find a really talented undergraduate student who you do not want to go in and say, no, don't do this. Well, do it with them, okay? Because even if you fail, it doesn't matter. You still engage them. And engaging an undergraduate research student is one of the biggest things you can do. That's an important point. So this is the fuzzy collaboration universe I was talking about, where we all feed off each other and we work. So any questions? Any? Since you do not have a question, let me go back and answer the one that you asked me. Our department doesn't have any requirements on research. And because of that, over the years, we've had students who've fallen through the loophole. And we have had students who've gone on to national conference and won best research awards. We've had NSF grants because of student research work. So what we realized was, well, there's a benefit to us and benefit to them. So what we did was the following. We said, while we're not mandating it, in some sense, if you do not do one, pick a research advisor. Before you graduate that last semester, you have to pick a small topic or a simple topic where you come in and show us what you can do. The project need not be very difficult. It could be a simple back of the chapter problem. But what we really look out for there is the way they present, the way they argue the physics, and the way their literature survey is done, so that they at least get an experience. I think that's the word that you use. They at least get a research experience. So in our department, we have two forms or outlets of how we can engage students in research. So it's not mandatory. No, you have to do it, but there's a mild form of it that we make sure that students can experience. Yeah. Okay. So whether it's a student, me, or a collaborator, our goal is always to go look and try and solve problems in magnetism. At least that's how my group is set up. So with that in mind, here's the first story I want to share about this guy, Billy. He used to be in the Air Force, and he was deployed in Iraq and did a lot of stuff and everything, but he came back and he wanted to get his degree in physics, okay? So he took my thermal physics class. That's the first class he took, and the reason was because when he was deployed, he would take these online courses in physics. He was excited about physics, but he didn't have a mentor. So he said, okay, I know the basic physics, let me take thermal physics. He took thermal physics with me, we started talking, and eventually that led to the Ising model. Eventually that led to me learning MATLAB with him to be able to produce enough results to get an NSF MRI grant. So the big thing about research in PUI institutions is that you can dream, okay? You can get yourself in a stage where you can be successful if you do it strategically. And he's right now a graduate student in theoretical biophysics at Ohio State. And there are so many papers I could have written with him, but I ran out of time. That's one of the problems you have, you run out of time. So that was the only one we just submitted. It was a conference proceeding at UGA. So he was one of those students who was really productive. We worked day and night. I mean, any time, there was not a time where we said weekends, weeknights, we just work, okay? And it took a little bit of, I like to do weekly meetings with my students. So I have different categories of meeting times. The ones who come in, initially I meet with them once a week. The ones who are in the middle stage of the career, I will meet with them maybe twice a week. And the ones who are my senior most research students, there is not a meeting time, we're talking always. Okay? Like, I'll text them and they'll text me back at 3 in the night. If it's APS meeting, I want it by tomorrow 4 o'clock. All right, you got it. So there's a certain level of, you had a question? sorry, so there's a certain level of friendship that you need to get with them, okay? It cannot be students walk in, here's a project, I'm a professor, come back after 4 weeks. I don't work like that. I do not work like that. I sit with them, we are friends, but there's a boundary, you know? They cannot come and insult me. we set up a certain level of comfort, a working comfort level where I try to extract. It's man management at the end of the day with undergraduate students. That's another key word. You got to be able to manage them properly. Here's the other person, Philip Javernick. Philip started off with a skill building project, which was synchronization in a chaotic Rosler oscillator. And then he developed more of his knowledge and skill by working on second harmonic generation and multiferroic materials. And interesting thing about this work was when he presented it at APS, we were feeding off a person called Manfred Fiebig, who's one of the world's leader in second harmonic generation. We had a picture of him on the slide to say, oh, this is the guy here, the experimentalist who does the work. And Philip told me, I was giving the talk, and I look up and I see Fiebig over there. So for a while he said, I got confused, wait, is this not the same person? So for an undergraduate, that's a rewarding experience. To see the person who's on your slide, to be in as a member of the audience, wow, I must have done something. And once it was done, he came up to him and said, oh, you did a great work. That's even better, okay? So take your students to conferences, even if they feel scared, and a lot of them will feel scared. You should take them to conferences. The third one was a spin wave theory of quantum magnetism. That was a graduate level project, but by that time he was finishing up and he had gotten accepted in UNC Chapel Hill. So we didn't pursue it. We have results that we've gotten there, but I never pursued the project. And I'm glad that he's working on theoretical physics. Actually, he's doing lattice simulations using QCD, which have applications in both lattices. Here's another person, Simeon. So Simeon worked on with me and another collaborator from Australia on Ising model, but 1/5 depleted site. And he is not in theory. He was disgusted with theory. So he joined experimental condensed matter. He said, I don't like theory. I think it's too tight. It doesn't allow my creativity to come along. So he became an experimentalist. So I think somebody brought up the point that when you go off to an RU or do a research project, an undergraduate research experience can be a great experience to know what you like or not like. And when I ask my students to go do REUs, I always tell them, if you worked with me, which you did, on condensed matter, your REU better be in astrophysics or biophysics or something which is experimental, not theoretical. You want to broaden your horizons. So the three students that I mentioned were mostly students from Georgia Regents University. But I decided to put my tentacles a little bit far out. And the first student that I managed in China was an undergraduate student, Zoe. He's right now a graduate student in Hong Kong University. And we published a paper on spintronics. And he is a very smart guy. He worked at Feynman diagrams in quantum magnetism using spin waves. That's pretty smart. If you're not in the field, you wouldn't realize it. But it takes a certain level of expertise to be working at Feynman diagrams at a level of undergraduate. But one second was the case where we had weekly Skype meetings, and when I was present there, we talked. So it's a question of constant engagement and making sure that you're always on them and not wait for them to come to you. That's very important. Okay, any questions? So right now, my current research group is made up of these students, and these are two of my graduate students from China, and these are my undergraduate students. He's a chemistry major. And there's a point that I forgot to mention, by the way. I just don't like to work with only physics majors. I work with CS majors to improve on my Ising model code so that they can code better. And when I pick my students, I don't pick just students who are good in what I do. I pick students who have strengths that are complementary to me. I don't code well. I like to think about code. I like to think about algorithms, but I don't like to code. That's why I have them, okay? I said, you like to code? I said, I hate to code, but do you like physics? They're like, yeah, but I don't understand it. I said, I'm an expert in physics. come along. So we form a team. So you pick people who are complementary to your skills. You don't want to pick the same person, because there is no way an undergrad would be better than you in spin wave theory. If he is, then we have either a problem or something's wrong here. but you know what I mean. So you pick someone who's complementary. And these guys over here, so Curtis is one of my students who's working on spin ice. He's the one who's doing that, trying to do that Monte Carlo on the spin ice I was telling you about. And Alex is the one who worked on, the X-ray spectra and the multiferroics. So those are very complicated projects, but he's pretty good actually. So he was able to do it. So that's my composition right now, group composition. And finally, as I said, all of that, I was with all that I've done, I was able to go convince my dean and my chair to allow us to float a material science seminar research series, because without a seminar series, the students now don't really see, because I've been trying to brainwash them and making them trying to believe that how important condensed matter and theoretical physics is. But when they see people from all over the world come in and national labs come in and say, oh, that's a good thing that you should do, then they really believe you. Otherwise, you know, they might think, hey, that's the only thing we can do, that's why we're doing it. This particular material science series, because of the merger, I also included biomaterials to make sure that anyone who's interested in biology-related physics is also inclusive. They can come and participate. And we have our traditional condensed matter talks, our material science talks, and the biomaterials. So every semester, the three speakers we have are typically one from area. So in spring of, what year is this, 15, right? Yeah. In fall of 15, right? We're going to have an experimentalist who's a chemist who's going to come in from Dallas. We're going to have the medicinal chemist give a talk on materials, medicine, or whatever. And the other person that we have another person, I can't remember who is, but he'll be there. But anyway, so this is the research program that we have been able to build at GRU in computational and theoretical condensed matter physics. But all of these all of these falls, to me, in my mind, this is the universe that we run in. And I'd like to hear from other people how this thing can deviate, or what can we do to make this better and more efficient, especially given the fact that we have to teach and we have to do service work and administrative work. So the question is, how can we do better? And finally, I want to talk about my failures too. Not everything is rosy. There are more of these that I haven't listed and you see on the slide. And the reason you see those two is because I wanted this to be a learning point or a lesson for the younger faculty in the audience. When you submit your grants, the two reasons you will find why you'll be denied: unreasonable, overambitious projects, that's a favorite line of the reviewers. And this one is not so much about reviewers, it's also more about, from your perspective, you don't want to have unreasonable student expectation, okay? You can become unreasonable when they see you also work. I've had colleagues who expect the world out of every student. If I give a project to my student, they should be here next week at 11 a.m. and they will do this and they will do that. And those are the same faculty who go to class late 2 minutes, who do not publish anything. And you know, so that's what you need to be in mind. You need to be the role model for them, for that kind of expectations to be put on them. And if you do that, then that would not be an issue. So with all said and done, those were my 2 cents on how to maintain a research program. Right, thank you. Yeah, sure.
You mentioned Algae Model has some maybe form of project that your students can do for conversation.
Yes. Yeah, good question. I love that question. Here's the reason why. Let's go back to that circle. The first student who worked on that project, Billy, he wrote the Ising model code from scratch because it was in his initial training skill building process. The next student who worked with me on the Ising model was Jones, the CS major. He rewrote that entire code in C++. Okay? And I made him reproduce the older results that Billy had gotten using the C++ code. Now, when it comes to undergrads and initial training, I'm not fixated on a project, and I'll tell you why. And I was talking about this with Matthew in the lunch. I'm teaching the BSMD students right now, okay? We have a program, 5-year program, where people come in and can automatically, or if they keep up their grades, can become a doctor. So some of these students came up to me and said, hey, we want to do research with you because we have heard you do research. I said, yeah, that's good, but I'm not a doctor, so I don't know what to teach you. He said, it doesn't matter, just give us something. And the other thing that I thought about when I was talking with them, cancer research is a big thing at our institution now. And in cancer, we have tumors, right? Tumors grow. If something grows, there's a differential equation. Oh, I know differential equations. So I told them we'll work on differential equations. So when I go back in fall, they will be working with me to do tumor modeling. Am I an expert on tumor modeling? No. Do I want to be? Maybe not. But there were two reasons why I went out of my way. First, I wanted to engage them. I did not want to lose them. Okay? And even if I do not work in that area, the fact that I would build a code from scratch to solve a set of coupled differential equations, I can use that code later on to solve coupled renormalization group equations. Right? So that's how I think about projects, but it's not always the same thing. And to answer your question, yes, every student that comes in, they do everything from scratch. And if I don't have a project that they can do from scratch, I usually don't tend to do that. Yeah.
Can you not show them the previous
ISO model? No. I talk with them. I talk with them every week. Of course, if they're stuck, I'll give them the code nugget just to push them, nudge them along. Yes. Hey, Matt.
So just to put you on the spot,
sure.
Thinking the right type of problem.
Do you have, choosing differential equations for growth of a tumor? That sounds manageable to me in a short period of time. Do you have a situation to where you overstepped, pick a project where somebody comes in?
Yes.
And you actually, it was too much for them. I'm just curious.
Yes, that has happened. It has happened with a biology major who was in my honors physics class. I know, Jamie Campbell, that's his name. He was a brilliant guy, got A's and everything on time, not a problem. He wanted to be a doctor. I said, okay. I was looking at these papers on epilepsy, and epileptic signals, they can be modeled using wavelets or Fourier transformation. So, and he needed an honors project, so we started doing that. But unfortunately, I realized after a year that biology majors can't code. They just don't think like that. There's a certain algorithmic way of thinking that I cannot get them to think, or at least I haven't found the solution to how to get them thinking that way. So yeah, that had been one project where I would classify underneath this either overambitious or unreasonable expectation. When I pick a student, I usually pick them because they have been in my class and I've studied them for a semester, so I know their traits. I know what they're able to do and what they cannot do. But there are times when I've made a mistake too. Yeah, a lot of times actually. Yes, Alex, go ahead.
First, if the next time you decide to do some tumor growth modeling, let me know because I've done a little bit on that.
Oh, cool, cool.
As far as students coming back on, our experience has been that CS101 or whatever your school calls it, the programming class for non-majors, is often highly variable in its quality, but math departments are increasingly having some sort of numerical methods class designed for their majors, where the goal is not just to teach them, here's how you write a loop, but here's how you use a loop to solve a problem where the variables are representing functions or mathematical objects that you are familiar with from other classes. And that is often a very useful thing. Do you have a similar bifurcation of classes and preparation in your school?
We do. Now, we have what they call CS1301 and CSCI 2016, which is administered jointly from the physics and the computer science department. A problem that we have at our institution is a nonlinear learning process. And what do I mean by that? Our classes are offered, some classes are offered every 2 years, and some are offered every year. sometimes some students don't go to the counseling center and fall through the loop, and they don't take these courses in order, okay? So I have had students who have gone through those classes with whom I would do computational projects which are heavy end. Or I will, what I do is when I get a student like that, I go back to my skill building initial training bubble, and I train them from the very book that they are going to be using when they take those courses. So I get both. And yeah, by the way, yeah, whenever I use a textbook, I don't use a textbook because I like it. I use the one that the instructor, the professor uses in their course for that particular topic. Because when I did the chaotic Rosler oscillator problem, I did that out of Marion and Thornton because that's the book we use. Okay, I don't want them, first of all, I don't want them to buy the book twice. But these books are costly. And the second thing is, there's a question of familiarity. You want them to be comfortable. You don't want them to be reading up 10 books. I mean, it just, for at least for most undergraduates, that can be a discomforting thing. So I get both. So depending upon who I get, the preparation level, I'll tune the project accordingly. But we do have something. And we also have a course on computational physics, and we have a course on numerical analysis. But I'll tell you what, I don't get those students at that level when they've gone through it. What happens is when they go through my projects and they go to that class, they're like, oh, this is so easy. These other guys are struggling. I'm the best. I mean, no, they're hot shots in that class at that time. Because they have seen all our method, they've seen that, they've done that. So that's what it is. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Not only for you and perhaps for all the audience, because right now there seems to be two paradigms in terms of integrating that into the curriculum. One is ask them to take this computer science 101 so that everybody learns programming. The other is in the physics curriculum, you integrate different computation components along the way, sophomore, junior, senior, and in the senior lab or whatever the equivalent is. So that was my curiosity in terms of all the participants here, what is the mold in your home institution? And I have a second point.
Yeah, so let me answer that question by, because I have been interested in developing these computational research group, what that led me to do is to introduce Visual Python in my introductory physics classes, okay? So I now introduce programming for all my physics majors at that introductory class because that's where I'm recruiting from. And because although we do not break it up into pieces in different upper level classes, they go through this series of courses, which is the other paradigm you're talking about, to get exposed to it. But the first effort in our department is what we do with the Visual Python thing. I think Don had a question, Alex?
Oh, just really, really quick, the comment was, I can't help but noticing that all of your students are male.
Oh, that was going to be my comment.
Oh, really?
So yeah. Just,
So, kind of curious what the recruitment process was like.
Just to connect with that, I was noticing that, and I know that physics departments, physics and computer science departments nationally are the ones that lag the most in gender diversity. But I'm also curious, not just for you, but in general, how research mentorship intersects with the issue of diversification of physics, because I think that's a place, anecdotally, what I would say that I've notice that maybe it's where some difference can be made, but anecdotes are always tricky. But
I work with who I get, you know. I mean, there is no policy in my group which says that women cannot join my group, but I mean, this is what we have. Most of the projects that I do, students take classes with me, upper levels or lower level classes, and then it's a mutual question of who wants to work with him, and that turns out. But as far as female physics majors are concerned, we have very few. And the ones we have are either interested in astrophysics or they're interested in the, we have a program for teachers, a physics degree with a teaching degree. Most of them want to go in that direction. Very few naturally express an interest to do hardcore physics research. So, you might flip that around and say, well, why don't you get them excited about it, but I haven't come across.
My question wasn't really so much about you, but about the general phenomenon of how classes, research, and various forms of diversity, gender diversity being the most obvious one to work on, but other forms of diversity as well, how that plays out, because it does strike me that research activity and research mentorship is a place for the one-on-one connection. We've had some faculty in our department who are particularly effective at plucking people out who would not have expected otherwise to be involved. And I just think it's something, I'd be interested to hear what people have to say, but I think it's also something for us all to think about as we struggle with this question, the pipeline question, all those things. So it's not meant to be a question about you in particular, but I think something that I think all our departments face in one way, I don't want to say struggle with, but face at one level or another, so.
So to answer your question, we took a positive step towards that direction by hiring a faculty, a woman, female faculty who is in theoretical/experimental work. Because that was our goal, that, you know, maybe the women in the department would be willing to work with them.
I wanted to respond to two things. First, about teachers, if there's anybody who needs to learn that physics research is about more than particle physics and astrophysics, the things that make the cover of popular science magazines, it is most definitely people who teach high school physics. So many people seem to be completely unaware that there are fields like condensed matter physics. But as far as JJ's question about how we introduce computation, if we put it into the lower division classes, at least at public universities, freshman physics is a factory. Large classes, room size constraints, textbook constraints, rotating casts of either TAs or adjuncts picking up sections at three other local community colleges. I have pushed for trying VPython or anything like that in the factory. If I start talking about what happens, then I'll probably have PTSD or something. I really think that in public universities, yes, I know they did it at NC State, but Sherwood and Shabai are amazing people. Yes, I know they did it at Long Beach State, but you have to understand we're completely different because we're 30 miles away, so obviously we're completely different. And I just think that that's something that either happens or it doesn't. I long ago gave up on that. But in any lower division class that I have control over, which means sophomore classes, first year experience, anything that is not subject to factory standardization, we happen to have a Mathematica site license, so I use that because there are some low activation barriers, but I'm not here to preach for Mathematica. Use anything, get them computing anything. I don't care what it is, but I think that bringing computation into the factory is just a non-starter too often.
Yes, I just want to mention something. I don't use Chabay's book. I've written my own notes. I've been inspired by Chabay and Sherwood because
the
reason I want to say this is because when I met Sherwood at the AAPT meeting, we were talking about it, and I was aware of his book. And one thing that I realized is I cannot use this book in my class because my students are not prepared at that level. So I still use Randy Knight's book, but I have my own Visual Python simulations because apparently I can code in Visual Python. So I use my own notes. So I think a strategy for you would be to make your own notes. We need a mild version, very mild version.
We need to start on the factory.
Okay.
Trust me.
Yes, here it goes.
All right, so I have integrated computational materials, and I also teach students Mathematica because that's the one that I'm most familiar with, and we also have a site license, so it's much cheaper. It's free for them. And I do it in the classical mechanics course that I used to teach because it worked nicely, and there was time in that course. There was not time in the sophomore level course that I taught because I was too busy teaching them about REUs and curriculum and writing lab reports and, yeah. There was already too much to grade. So, and then I'm going to incorporate computational work into the StatMech course that I'll be teaching starting this fall. So I guess I put it in wherever I happen to be teaching because I'm the one that does it. So I'm not sure why that is. But yeah, and then I would also agree with Alex about sometimes women are not aware that something is open to them or is a possibility, and so they in terms of research, and so they just, you know, follow along. And I'm sure all your students have been wonderful. And I do think that opening up and making sure that we're recruiting people who are not just the people that went to a high-powered high school and so therefore are slightly ahead of people. And I'm not saying that this is what you're doing. I'm just, actually, this is my problem. So it's one of the things that I want to make sure, because I didn't have advanced math coming in. I started at calculus my first year, although many of my research students had calculus in high school and were just already ahead. And I don't think that good physicists are all the people that were already ahead starting at the beginning of college. I think they come from many backgrounds, and mostly I see them as, you know, under-tapped backgrounds. And so I want to make sure that we get those. And so I think just being aware of that, but everybody has different strengths, and I'm sure, you know, the solution is different for each location. So
on the problem or issue of diversifying your student body, I think this is well known in the community, and we've had some success with it, is to create a comfortable interactive environment within your department. So Dada mentioned, you know, student clubs, right? And then, look, it's us, the faculty. Just the attitudes, how you approach your students made a big difference. I'm fortunate in that we have two very accomplished female faculty members in our department. That helps, but I don't know what the breakdown is, but I don't know, it might be 35-40% female students, undergraduates in our department maybe. Some have been extremely successful as they've gone on, and so they've come back to help, right, and just to talk. But really, it's the attitude is huge. So I don't really know how to, other than that. On the issue of programming, we've tried to do similar things that have already been mentioned. All of our students have to take a traditional, you know, programming one level class, and our Department of Computer Sciences dropped C++ and C, and everything is Java. They don't teach C or C++. So, but you know, they learn some basics. We've tried to incorporate some numerical stuff, and mainly have focused on MATLAB, because again, we have a site license for it. But I have found that if, even after taking the one or two courses, that it's one thing to learn how to program, to just do a loop, like Alex said, but you need to be able to do these things in a scientific sense. And people fall down, right? You really do need to spend a lot of time. And I found, again, writing up some notes or, I don't know, a PowerPoint presentation that goes through and leads them through setting up the, I got to even log on to the Linux box, right? Fire up the program. Open up the editor, write this down, say hello world, or how to get started, and then say, now we're going to do this. It's really at sometimes that level, but that is a lot of work.
I was wondering if you could talk about your experience with how much time management of your students you need to do professionally.
Yeah, sure. I, as I said, I meet with my students. Okay, maybe I'm not understanding your question, but I'll answer it and let me know if I'm making sense. I meet with, where are they? Are they gone? Right there, right there. So I meet with every one of them once a week at least. And I classify my students, as I said, outside major, physics, outside majors, and then physics majors. I typically tend to devote more time with my physics majors. By that, I mean I meet with them more than once a week. And the two senior group members get even more attention, meaning I will talk with them almost daily. I'll find them in the corridor and nudge them or ask them questions. If you're asking me whether I need to keep on nudging them to get results out of them, is that the question? Are you talking about whether they're responsible enough with the work?
I find this situation might be unique for me because my students have unusual time demands. And so unless I I start forcing time demand so that they actually put aside time to do research, it's something that gets overrun by their other requirements.
So we have a set, we do have a set weekly time when we have to meet. Now, if there is a week when they have an exam or they have to go outside for some kind of a trip, I'm okay with that so long as they come in and make up for that next week with two or three meetings. And if you do not do that with me, I will not work with you. That's the first year of training. I'll let them know. I will work with you only if you, you know, so it's not a, for me, there are strict boundaries. I will not just accept anyone. And the reason is because when I tell you I'll prepare you, I will make sure you go to a graduate school and you will get your PhD, even though I will not be there with you to get your PhD. That's how I will train you. So I tell them what I will deliver as a product. I tell them I will make, give you a publication. I tell them I will get you to national conferences. So I tell them what I will do for them. When I do that with them for the, after the first year, and even when I don't do them, I have a strict schedule in which they have to follow. If they do not follow that, I will not work with them. I will find someone else to work with. But on the question of accountability, I have a student right now who I'm paying over summer who hasn't showed up for the last 2 weeks. And part of it could be because I'm traveling, part of it because, you know, even though I text him and saying, hey, what's the update for this week, he might be busy with something more important, family emergency. But then I have two more students, these two, who I'm talking over Skype and texting and doing stuff. So it also depends on the student. So you'll always get a mix. Now, if everybody is like the first student I talked about, then it could be the culture in the department. It could be the culture in the department. I don't know, as I'm saying, I'm speculating here. I'm not sure what the solution is. But I do spend a lot of time with them. I don't look at myself as doing an 8-to-5 job. It's, for me, it's a 24/7 thing. I will, if they send me an email at 12 in the night, I'll reply back to them. So.
Somebody had a question?
Sorry.
Yeah. I'm not willing to put that much time in, 24/7. I think that balance in life is important. And I don't know, I think maybe that's personality also as to what works best with people, but so when I meet with my students, I meet once to twice a week, depending. Usually we have a group meeting where everyone comes, and then we then I have project meetings where I meet with the group that's working on a particular project. And I've also had students that won't get things done unless you push them to, so I create lots of deadlines. To force that to happen. I've also had the reverse problem where I've had students who work so hard and for so long that they literally just get sick and then they don't get as much done. So I've tried to introduce the idea that maybe they should take some time off occasionally and sleep, you know, randomly, or maybe exercise, eat right. So I tried to introduce these basic health habits that for some reason they didn't pick up in K-12. I'm not really sure why that happened, but I think it's, I do protect one day out of my weekend, which is usually a Saturday, where I don't do any work, and I rest, and for me that's really important. I think that having a time period where you do some resting is good, but it's only been like two students I've had to pull them aside and say, you must spend a day resting at some point, or at least 4 hours, you know, I mean, whatever it takes, so. And usually if you explain to it that they're going to get more done that way, they'll buy into it.
If I could just ask the one quick show of hands, how many students a year, if you hold up fingers, what's the typical number of students that people end up supervising? Like how many? I'll have two students probably next year that I'll work with. What's a typical number?
During the academic year?
During the academic year.
Is that average over all the years, or three or four?
Yes, average.
In all fields, or is this?
You'll be responsible for whatever field they're in. Yeah.
So I usually average six.
And how about summer?
Summer.
So I should make a distinction here. The students that you see up over here, they don't work with me just over summer. We have one credit, two credit, three credit courses, and they work with me throughout the entire year. So I don't necessarily make a distinction. I don't make a distinction between summer research and research is research. You do it year long. So that's the distinction. And the administration recognizes that for us. So.
I actively push my students to go somewhere else and do some other kind of research during the summer because I think they should, like you mentioned, have a diverse
REU,
experience.
Yeah, absolutely. If they get an REU, that's where they go. But if they don't get an REU, or actually even if they get an REU, I work around their schedule to make sure that they're still in the mode of doing the stuff I was doing. But the key word for me here is engagement, that you need to be engaged with your student and whatever form suits your, as you said, personality or whatever form suits the student. But it cannot be where, like the graduate student and postdocs, you give them a project and the teacher doesn't, professor doesn't know what they're doing and they don't know what they're doing and they meet after 2 months. It's just constant interaction is important for me, I've seen.
Thank you again.